All right, Erev Tov, everybody. Ready to get started, Dr. Yeah. Mark?
Well, it's the 4th of April, 2022, 3rd of Nisan. I'll get started just for everyone who's listening and is going to be listening later on YouTube. We're all getting ready for Pesach, so we're not focusing on it. But as soon as Pesach's over again, we're going to be back focusing on the trips. There's room. The Portugal one is pretty close to the end.
Basically sold out.
There's still a couple, but we have plenty of room on the other trips. So looking forward to getting some new people we haven't seen yet. I just want to put my other computer on here. Okay. Very good, everyone. Pleasure to be here. As always, a few things. One of the great things of these classes is that I only grew up like in my neighborhood and I've been to shuls, but it's a very small slice of the Jewish world. So sometimes I say like things like, I've never heard this. And people say, no, they do it here, they do it there. So that gives me an opportunity to find out how it's done elsewhere, which and I'm going to give you two examples of that right now in these prefatory comments. And you'll tell me if it's just that in my area, they don't do it. Thank you first for Robert. I said Rabbi Hartman asked who published the volume of the Rav on Sukkah, and I said Rabbi Herschel Reichman, but I said he was a rabbi in Englewood. It's actually his son, Rabbi Zev Reichman. So thank you for pointing that out, Robert. We spoke last class, we were talking about the Omer. And I remembered then that there was a response of the Rav Abadi in the Or Yitzhak, Volume 2, and it's number 212. And he deals with this whole business of not having weddings, how there's a minhag not to, although the Shulchan Aruch does say that if you do marry someone, we ain't onshino, so we don't punish him because it's a mitzvah. But l'chachilu, we don't have weddings. But someone asked him, what about a sudas bar mitzvah with dancing? And he says, halacha l'maisa, that it's only with weddings, that's the minhag, but a bar mitzvah, he says, there's no such concept of a bar mitzvah. Bar mitzvah is a sudas mitzvah, and you can have rikudim and dancing and everything. And his words are, sudas mitzvah, kabar mitzvah, uchadome, so I'm wondering, I can't remember. I'm not at that age now with my kids. Do we have bar mitzvahs? On Shabbos we do, but during the week, do people have bar mitzvahs during the Omer in which we have dancing? I mean, he's talking about you can have a band. You can have a band also if you wanted, but I'm just wondering, I can't remember. Do we have, so you could do in the chat, but even if you didn't have a band, you just have dancing and everything. He says there's no concept at all. It's for a sudas mitzvah, it's fine. And then at v'chadoma. So what does that also mean? There could be, I guess, a dinner, a yeshiva dinner. That's a sudas mitzvah, I think, or finishing a masechta. But I think that we don't have bar mitzvahs with dancing during Sfira, except it's on Shabbos. That's my recollection. But he says there's no issue at all. Put this over here. Jacob, Yaakov, challenges is me when I said that I think the real meaning of the Hadron is we'll return to you, you'll return to us. And I said it's probably a drash, like a nice homiletic, that Hadron means our glory upon you, your glory upon me. And Jacob argues, no, just the opposite. That's the actual meaning. Well, I tell you, if you look in Sperber's book, Volume 1, Minhagei Yisrael, Chapter 18, he brings both. There's big authorities on each side. Part of the issue is that there is a mistranslation. I thank you, Jacob, for pointing it out. Although it's usually translated as Hadron, Hadaran Allah, Masachas Brachos, let's say, Hadaran Allah, that we will return to you. As Jacob points out, it can't mean that because you'd have the Nun preface if that was the case. So what it really means, however, is Hadaran Allah, we returned upon you and you returned upon us. Whatever that means, it's a little strange. But later, then it says, Daitanach Masachas Brachos, Daitanach Alan. Lo nisnashe minach wasachas brachos. That's the future. Lo nisnashe minan. So it says, we will not forget you and you will not forget us. So you get both, I guess they're both right. Now I'm going to get to what I said about the confirmation, because I promised about mitzvah. And the one who asked me about Beryl Wine's book, the new book, which is very relevant, it's all about orthodoxy and the defense of orthodoxy. It's very relevant, the things we're doing in this class. I'll mention that next class. I took some notes on it, and there's a number of mistakes I'll point out, so much so that I believe, I mean, he's no youngster today, that I will show you things where I find it hard to believe he wrote it. I think he had an assistant, and there's just certain things that I don't believe he could have written. Well, just for instance, I am certain, I know that Rabbi Wein knows that Yeshiva University is spelled without an H at the end. So when you have Yeshiva University on not just once, but again and again, spelled with an H, I have to think that some copy editor, and he didn't read it over, someone put that in. And I'll show you other examples of that as well. And I'll take issue with some of the things that Rabbi Wein says. I do want to talk about the confirmation for a minute. That's a reform, and that's going to be part of our story, depending on how long we continue, because the Reform Institute, this confirmation, which a confirmation is, it's really an act of the youth confirming his or her faith. So what does that do with bat mitzvah? Because I connected them, and we dealt with Rabbi Aaron Volkin, the Rav of Pinsk, and his Zakan Aaron, and I looked in the Zakan Aaron because I thought I remembered it, and I was correct. His language is, can you do, he actually uses the word confirmation, and he calls it Chag HaBagrut, Beit HaKnesset. So what does this have to do with bat mitzvah? Well, what it has to do with bat mitzvah is the following, that what the Reform did is they took the confirmation, and then this was the first time that you recognized a girl. Now, a girl reaching an age where she could be, let's say, a member of the community. And then that later morphed into bat mitzvah. It wasn't the Orthodox. And the Orthodox, who did this at first, and the Orthodox always assumed that the bat mitzvah and the confirmation were the same thing, that they're just a practice that was taken, first a confirmation, then you change the name. Now, whether that's right or not, we can argue. Just to give you an example, the Sri Deyesh, his response on bat mitzvah is the most famous of them all. Well, it's in volume 3, number 93. And he says, there are those who wish to forbid it because of the luchuk hoseya. Don't take the non-Jewish practices. And who does he quote? The Zakan Aaron. So the Sri Deyesh is saying it's the same thing, that confirmation, bat mitzvah, they all come from the non-Jews, which have then been transformed by the irreligious. And that's the whole basis of his tshuva, where he deals with it. The whole tshuva that he deals with that. So that's why you see all these connections between confirmation and bat mitzvah. We have a nice anniversary here because I didn't even realize this, but we are now in it's the 100th anniversary of the first U.S. bat mitzvah. That's Mordechai Kaplan's daughter, Judith Kaplan. She would later marry Ira Eisenstein, who the son of grandson of Judah David. Yeah, it's the grandson, not the son of the grandson. I'm forgetting now. Judah David Eisenstein, if you remember he was the encyclopedist, the Otsar Havikuchim, Otsar. He had like 15 different Otsars. Now I can't remember if he's the grandson. Yes, he's the grandson of Judah David Eisenstein. Those books are not used so much anymore because they have better editions. But anyone who used Sfarim 30, 40 years ago, you remember all the different Otsars, Otsar Dinimum and Hagim, full of good stuff. The final thing I want to mention gets back to one of the last things we spoke about last class, Rabbi Herman Adler. We were dealing, and a few people emailed me about this, about the Tkias HaShofar at the end of Yom Kippur. So we saw Rabbi Adler with his Beis Din's suggestion to end the Ilah before, like 7 minutes or so. It doesn't give a time, but that's 7 or 10. That's what you find shuls doing. They end Shabbos. They start Ma'ariv, and that's why they finish Ma'ariv right when it's over. And then they say Havdalah. And that way, no one's, they don't have to blow the shofar or anything. So after that, I was speaking to my son, about the, this question, it's before Seis. So the Shulchan Aruch says that you have to recite Kriyat Shema in the evening after Seis HaKohavim. And yet I can say, and a lot of shuls start, some wait until Shabbos is over to do Ma'ariv, but lots of shuls, as we, where I've been growing up, it's very standard. You start 7 minutes, 10 minutes, and then you finish up, but right when you get to the end, the Hinoam or Aleinu, right when it's time for Havdalah. Some shuls I've seen where they start a little too early because someone's already carrying the Havdalah set, but it's not really, Shabbos isn't over yet. You still have 1 or 2 more minutes. So that's a problem. But it's very common. Now, I've never seen, maybe you've seen, I've never seen a rabbi tell the shul, Motzei Shabbos, when you start, let's say, 7 minutes before Tzeis HaKohavim, you start Ma'ariv, to repeat Shema Nesri. To repeat Shema. Now, why not? You said Shema 5 minutes before Tzeis HaKohavim. Didn't we just say that you have to repeat... you have to say Shema after it says. Furthermore, I'll take it one step further, that shuls, I was in shul tonight, we waited till Shkia. It's a, I think for a minion, it's a chumrah. I mean, if you have a group, as a tzibur, the Mishnah Berurah says you don't need to wait, but it's only, you don't need to wait to Shkia. There's a stira, you know, this internal stira, but okay, it was just a couple of minutes. How many people say Kriyat Shema at night again, the full Kriyat Shema? I think then if the rabbis would say you should, but it's not like the announcement, it's not like to make a big deal, and I think very few people do say it. There is a shita, Rabbeinu Tam, that you don't have to wait till Tzeis HaKohavim to do Kriyat Shema. I think in how I look at the Jewish world, it seems that the Olam, without knowing it, is relying on the Rabbeinu Tam, because they don't repeat it. But I know the rabbis, at least my experience is, they do say you should repeat it, but they never say a word about repeating it after, I mean, you're davening Ma'ariv, Shabbos is ending in 10 minutes. They never say to repeat it. So I was wondering about that. I actually sent to 3 online things, just, you know, these sites you can ask. One of them said, absolutely, you have to repeat, even though, let's say, Shabbos is over at 9 o'clock, you do Kriyat Shema at 8:55, you have to then repeat it later that night. Another one wrote to me, he's not clear. He doesn't know, because there are opinions that Seis is earlier and that just on Shabbos, we extend it a little. And then the third one is Eretz Chemda. I got the Eretz Chemda yesterday. And Eretz Chemda is absolutely, he says, there's no reason you have to repeat Shema Motzei Shabbos. He says that the Tzeis HaKohavim that we do Motzei Shabbos is, we extend it because of Kedusha Shabbos, or maybe Tosefes Shabbos, but there's shitas that hold that an earlier Tzeis is okay, and since it's only a few minutes, 5 minutes or so earlier, you are definitely Yotze, and there's no reason that you have to repeat it. So, and that's clearly the minhag, unless in your shul they tell you, it wouldn't make any sense, because any rabbi who's going to tell you to repeat Kriya Shema later in the evening is going to say, well, let's start davening at Seis. Any rabbi who says we're going to daven 7 minutes before Seis is going to assume it's okay. And Eretz Chemda says it's fine. So that's all I wanted to talk about today. I want, and as preface, but now let's get back to our comments, our discussions. And we're picking up in the Sefer, who are going to look, actually, in the Sefer Ela Devar Habris. But before we get to that, I want to mention something I told you, because I think it, I love these fascinating stories I'm going to tell you. They're, none of them are true, but they reveal an insight into the world and what's thought of as something to admire. Although it's not just us listening who are going to be shocked, and not, and I don't think anyone listening is going to see it admirable. I've asked Haredim about this, and they too are very troubled by these sorts of stories, because we live in a whole totally different world than what it's like. And it's not just in English speakers, but in particular English speakers, like when they translated, Art Scroll translated the biography of Rav Yoshev into English, they took out sections. In the Hebrew biography, they played up the fact that he didn't have any personal relationships, even with his family, because he was Kulo Torah. So much so that it says that they couldn't remember his children's names. When Art Scroll translated that, they knew that that wouldn't play well, so they got rid of it. They took that stuff out. But this is the story I'm going to tell you. If the letter of the Dayanim to Rabbi Moshe Sofer, Schreiber, the Chasam Sofer, says, it mentions his father-in-law, Rabbi Akiva Eger, the Rav of Poza. The Chasam Sofer was married three times. First wife, no children. Second wife, that's the daughter of Rabbi Akiva Eger, he had all of his children with, and then he married a third time. If you come this summer to Central Europe, I've showed you already the grave of the Panimiros of Meir of Eisenstadt, but right near there is the grave of Rabbi Akiva Eger's, not his father, I think it's just his mother, not his father, as I recall. But unbelievable, going Rabbi Akiva Eger, I don't know if it's a year or 1 year older than his son-in-law, the Chasam Sofer. And there's all sorts of stories of their connection. But I want to read you now one of the most famous stories. It's repeated in many, many places with slightly different versions. But the one I'm reading from is from Ramosha Sternbach, his Tam Vadas, Volume 1, pages 244, 245. And he's quoting it from Rabbi Kahaneman from the Ponevez Yeshiva. But and in case you think, well, this is a Litvak, what do they know about the Hungarian traditions? The same story is found in, not only is it found in Hungarian traditions, it's even found in the family. But here's the story. You tell me what you think. It says that when the... and Rabbi Kahneman got this from his father-in-law. When the Chasam Sofer's wife died, the daughter of Rabbi Akiva Eger, they didn't tell her father that she passed away. Now, that's believable because there was a tradition in Europe that you didn't, not just in Europe, that you didn't tell. Like today, we always tell. There was a tradition you didn't tell this news. People would get letters, you know, a few times a year. They didn't pass this news on. And there's no chiyuv to tell people about that. When they learn about it later, if they learn about it a year after the fact, then you can look at the Shulchan Aruch, what type of avelos you do. So, okay, so they didn't tell Rabbi Akiva Eger, and he thought she was still alive. And lo and behold, it happened that Rabbi Akiva Eger was near Pressburg. And he told, he announced that he wants to go spend Shabbos at the house of the Chasam Sofer, that he hasn't seen him in many years. And the Chasam Sofer didn't know what to do now because he already married someone else. So he has a new wife, his third wife. And he never told the Chasam Sofer. And the story here says that he consulted with his wife and she was ready to leave the house for Shabbos. But the Chasam Sofer said she should stay in the house. And that's everyone has that version, actually. Yeah. Erev Shabbos, it says, when he there comes to the Chasam Sofer's house, They say to him that the Chasam Sofer is at the Beis Din. He goes there and immediately they get into a discussion about a get that the Chasam Sofer is dealing with. The Danuvu Pilpulu Ad Samach Knisa Shabbos. So they're talking and learning until Shabbos begins. Then they bathe themselves and they go to the mikvah and they accept Shabbos and they continue talking at the meal. And they're so involved in their learning the whole Shabbos. As soon as Havdalah comes, the Rabbi Akiva Eger is about to leave, and he says he has to hurry, he has to run. He doesn't even have time to speak to his daughter. He just asks her, the Chasam Sofer, to give her a drishat shalom. So here we're supposed to imagine that Rabbi Akiva Eger comes to the house of the Chasam Sofer. He's there the whole Shabbos, in the house, eating all the meals, and he doesn't realize that the woman sitting at the table is not his daughter because he's so involved in learning. Now, I don't believe it. I don't believe it's possible. I don't care how great a lamdan you are. But the fact that the story's told, notice what the stress is on. The stress is on that limud Torah above personal relationships. I think for most of us, we would say that's terrible. Your child, Rabbi Lichtenstein, by the way, has a comment about this, about these ideals that you're not supposed to have relationships with your children because you're supposed to be involved so much in learning, how much he thinks how terrible it is. But notice the stress here. And no one, Rabbi Moshe Sternbach, wouldn't say that we're supposed to be like this. But it becomes a model for people of a different level. And there's other stories about the two of them and an interesting correspondence. Let's talk now. I want to introduce you to a new book, a very important book. Let me pull it up here for you so you can see. I want to get to the first page of it. We saw Noga HaTzedek, and now we're going to see Eila Divrei Hebrus. This is published by the anti-reformers. And again, as we start looking at this work, remember the big problem we're going to have. If something is mutar, according to the Shulchan Aruch, can the rabbis say it's usur? And if they do say it's usur, on what basis can they say it's usur? Can the rabbis declare something usur because they think it's going to have negative communal implications, even if technically it's mutar? And if they do, do they have to explain what they're doing, or can they keep the masses in the dark and have the masses think that it's forbidden, where it's only the rabbis know that it's really not technically forbidden, but we think it's going to have bad implications and is going to lead to problems? That's something to keep in mind. Now, with the responses we're going to see here in the Ego Dever Bris, we really see the beginning of orthodoxy. Well, what does orthodoxy mean? How does it differ from tradition? Usually, due to the influence of Jacob Katz, we see traditional Judaism as something imbibed in the home, something you do unconsciously. That's the way you grow up. Whereas orthodoxy is a self-conscious adherence to tradition. No longer is there an expectation that you have to observe. You're conscious of it. You make a conscious choice to go against the grain, as it were, and to adopt practices that there's no outside pressure telling you you have to, and you're even a minority. You choose to be observant. In a traditional society, you never chose to be observant. That was the way you grew up, and that's orthodoxy. And we're going to see that orthodoxy is not really identical with traditional Judaism. There's some different steps that orthodoxy takes. Obviously, they all observe kosher, Shabbos, etc. But in terms of how to deal with problems, traditional responses are different than orthodox responses. Orthodox responses, I guess you'd say, even more reactionary. Therefore, if you look, for instance, in the Sephardic world, certain things that would never be imaginable in the Ashkenazic world, because they were never really what we call an orthodoxy. But so here's the title page of this work, Ego Divrei Abrit. Let me just summarize it for you. These are the words of the covenant that cannot be changed ever. Based upon, and now we're going to hear the psak of the Beis Din of Hamburg, and the rabbis of Hamburg, the Dayanim. Their hand was strengthened by the Gedolim in Ashkenaz, Germany, then Poland, in France, in Italy. That's going to be important because, remember, you had two rabbis in Italy supporting the Nogat Sedek work. Umedinat Bemen, that's Bohemia. Bohemia is today the Czech Republic, Prague, and going south. And then Meren, that's Moravia. If you go even more south, we drive up in our trip. We drive up from Vienna right through Moravia into Bohemia, then Ungarn, Hungary. So you have a lot of rabbis responding. Kulam ke'echad. As one, they're responding. Zeres irin piskama of a mamar kadishin she'elasa. This comes from Daniel. That's, they're making the decree. Now, look, what are they decreeing? Lafer to blanket, get rid of das hadasha. Remember we said a new religion. What the argument is going to be that reform is a new religion. And we saw already last class why that's important, because new religions are forbidden by the government. And this work is intended to support the position of the rabbis of Hamburg, that this is a new sect and they have to be shut down by the government. And in parentheses, it says that Eze Yechidim Hedyotim, who are not B'nai Torah, invented this new religion. They came up with practices, Shalom Kadas Moshe Yisrael, not according to Torah. And therefore, the Gaonim have stood up, Litkoa Yated Bin Kom Ne'aman. This comes from Yishayahu, it means to fasten a peg in a sure place. And we have the newspaper, Yated Ne'aman. Although, I think with one exception, Yated is always feminine. So it's really a mistake. It should be not Yatei Neman, Yatei Nemana. I heard this, I learned this from Rabbi Nussan Kamenetsky. He told me that. And it was his proof that Yatei Neman from the very first words is mistaken. He said that it's, that even the Yatei Neman is wrong because it should be Yatei Nemana. But I looked, I think one place it is feminine. The new Jewish Review of Books will be out next week, supposedly, and my long-awaited article that they commissioned, and then it took forever. on Rav Nosson Kamenetsky will appear. I already saw the article in type. So if you get the Jewish Review of Books, you shall, you'll be able to read about Rav Nosson Kamenetsky. And then it goes on. What did these great rabbis agree with? That you can't change any prayer, any Seder Tefillah of that's practiced in Israel from Birkas HaShachar to after Alino Shabbat. And certainly you can't get rid of it. Two, you can only daven in Hebrew. And anything, any prayer that's not according to our practice, you can't pray, you can't do anything from it. And three, you can't daven, you can't play, sorry, in a shul, any instrument on Shabbos and Yom Tov, even by a non-Jew. Notice it says Shabbos and Yom Tov, because we're going to see the Chasam Sofer. He doesn't think Shabbos and Yom Tov. He thinks any time. And that's the, and then it says it goes on, and you see the Beis Din of Hamburg. Now, this idea that you can't change any of the minhagim, any of the Seder Tefillah, any, what about the fact the Hasidic movement? The arguments we're going to see, how it's forbidden to make any changes. Also, Shanos Seder Tefillah. What about the fact that the Hasidim come in and they say that they changed Nusach Ari, and they or Nusach Sfard, what you want to call it. How is that justified? They do justify it. Although, based on the arguments we're going to see, you can reject the Hasidim as well. So let's begin. Let's go through the book again, and I'm going to call attention to some important points. So it begins. I'll just skim through with the Hamburg Dayanim, with their letter to the rabbis and setting forth the three prohibitions. Now, in addition to what they have, they also say you can see it right there. The big word. They built a synagogue and they called it a. They built a Beis Tefillah and they called it a temple. So you see right there. And that's already, and then it goes on. They said they added prayers, they omitted prayers. They put most of the prayers in German, not Hebrew. They omitted everything having to do with Kibbutz HaGolios, to returning to Zion. And that makes them, it says, Kofrim Be'ikar, because they reject the Messianic idea. So they're heretics. Women, they had women singing in the choir when the temple was dedicated. Furthermore, the Dayanim go on and say they use an organ. They abolish the Silent Amidah. They abolish the Maftar. We've seen all this. They abolish the Haftarah. Instead of the Haftarah, they have the preacher preaches. They read here's one we haven't seen yet. Hamburg, in some ways, is more radical than Berlin. They read the Megillah in Megillas Esther in German from a printed Chumash. And many other things that show that these reformers in Hamburg reject the authority of Chazal. Now, following the statement of the long letter of the Dayanim, the three Dayanim signed, what do you have it here? You have it in Judeo-German, or Yiddish, I guess you can call it. This is for the masses, which then can be translated for the Hamburg Senate. But the masses, they don't know. Well, they need to be shown exactly what the problem is, and later they translate to what the rabbis have to say. Let's see, I want to show you, in the second half of the book, everything is translated. So you can read, if you're a Pashut Balabas and you don't know what the deal is, you can see the Chasam Sofer, his letter, and all the other letters of the Gedolim are translated for you. So let's get back now to the beginning. What they left out, if you look later in the German, the Yiddish, they left out the detailed halachic arguments. They just got to give the important stuff. You don't need all the details because some of the letters are short, but others go into more detail halachic argumentation. Okay, I want to call your attention just to a few of the letters. There's many, 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 many letters. Again, one of the big issues is the Mishnah Sota we saw, which state you can daven in any language. We understand why this is a problem. If all of a sudden now, all over the world now, people are davening in any language, I go to France, let's say I go into shul there, I can't participate in the service because it's in French and I don't know French. So we understand why it's a problem. Most of the respondents in this volume do not say anything significant. All they do is they affirm the Hamburg Beis Din is correct that you can't change any tefillos. The reformers are breaking halacha, Jewish tradition. While all the letters are historically interesting, I just want to call your attention to a few that add significant points to discussion that help us illuminate part of the problems. The first letter I want to call your attention to is on page, from page 2 to 6. It's from an individual who's not known at all. He's not a significant figure, but his name was Hertz Shire, and he was the rabbi in Mainz, in Germany, because he makes a number of interesting points. He says, first of all, he speaks obviously of the great importance of minhag, of practice, how we can't change what's become communal practice. That already itself is important. But then he notes that when you get into vernacular translations, it's a problem, because every translation, you lose something. The original Hebrew contains meanings that can't be reproduced in translation. I want to show you here, page 3, where, if you want to look, if not, I'm going to tell you, 4 lines from the bottom, he begins here, Umihai Taima. He says, I'll summarize for you. He says, for everything we've said, Belis Safek, without doubt, all Jews everywhere accept upon themselves to pray only in Hebrew in order to fulfill the decree of Ezra, you know, a public prayer that should be in the best possible way, Atzara Tov, only in Hebrew. And that's true. Everywhere you go, shuls were in Hebrew. And they didn't pay attention. They didn't take into account the Beferish, the explicit Mishnah, that says you can daven in any language. And then he says that I think this means no one ever objected to this notion of praying in Hebrew. He says, Adarabba, on the contrary, in the early generations, the women did not know Hebrew at all, and they still prayed in Hebrew. The davening was still in Hebrew. Not exactly 100% accurate. We know that there were places where they prayed in the vernacular, but he says, despite the fact that you had a whole half a population where they didn't know Hebrew, they still kept the prayers in Hebrew. And although there are places here and there where we know the women in an organized fashion prayed in the vernacular, those are exceptions. 99.9% of the time, the women would come to shul and just listen to the Hebrew. And then he says, Uvazeh achshir darei zeh zman rav. He says, our generation is better. Why? Because he says men and women, they know a bit about Hebrew and they learn it from their youth. And therefore, this is proper that they know it. And we have to then, therefore, we pray. It's proper to fulfill the mitzvah of prayer the way it's supposed to be done. Just about Ezra, before I explain this. Ezra, the Rambam at the beginning of Hilchos Tefillah, in chapter 1, Halacha 4, he describes how Ezra organized the prayers, since people didn't know how to formulate their own prayers. A lot of discussion where the Rambam gets this, because this idea that it doesn't seem to have any explicit source for Rambam's reconstruction of how they decided to formulate obligatory prayers by Ezra. But that's what the Rambam says. Now, Rav Shire, when he says that the not knowing Hebrew, he means they didn't know in the earlier generations, the women. And by the way, it's not just the women, it's the men too. We like to think that all men were illiterate. It's not true. We know that there was illiteracy among men as well. That is, men who could not read the Siddur. But what he means is when he says they know Hebrew now, it doesn't mean they understand it. Just like today, half the people should learn to understand it. It means they can read it. And when he says that in early years, women didn't know Hebrew, it means they didn't even know how to read it. Of course, then you have the question, which we discussed at the very, very beginning of my class on my latest book. How then did women bench? How did they say brachos? How did they daven? And as we saw, and I'm not going to go through the whole discussion then, they didn't. The Magen Avraham says that women can, he justifies the practice, that the women they come up with, they do a little prayer on their own, because the women didn't know this. We read the Tshuva of Masas, who says how in Morocco they didn't do any brachos, and I raised the question, they couldn't teach them brachos, and they didn't do benching, and it's, I can't explain, as we discussed in more detail then, why they didn't try to, in a better fashion to try to change this. It was a different society. People were living in villages by themselves. Not like today where people lived in towns where they didn't have minyanim. And it was a whole different environment. They got married very young. Many women were just completely ignorant. They say the Chafetz Chaim's wife used to sit next to him when he benched. And that was her benching. I think that's even mentioned by the son in the introduction, if I'm not mistaken, to Kisei Chafetz Chaim. If not there, it's elsewhere. So that is true. So he says, but now things have gotten better and they know Hebrew. So there's no reason to do it in the vernacular. And then he goes on to say that the Mishnah in any event is only referring to people who don't know Hebrew. If you don't know Hebrew, then you can read it in another language. But if you know Hebrew, by which he means if you read it, you must pray in Hebrew if you can read Hebrew. He says that Hebrew is different than other languages, because if you hear a prayer in Hebrew and you don't understand it, you're yotze. However, if I read you a prayer, tefillah b'chol lashon, we can do davening in any language. If I read a prayer for you in Spanish and you don't know Spanish, he says you are not yotze. Hebrew, not only are you yotze if you don't understand it, if you read it, you're yotze. If I read a prayer in Spanish and I don't understand Spanish, I'm not yotze. Hebrew is special because if I read the prayer in Hebrew, I'm yotze, and if I hear it in Hebrew, I'm yotze, even if I don't understand it. So here, all of a sudden, you see a big difference between him and the reformers. From the reformer standpoint, none of this makes any sense. They're not interested in the technicality, are you yotze or not? The reformers were saying that the people don't understand Hebrew, and therefore, we should not have prayers in Hebrew. Prayer is about reaching man speaking to God. What good is man speaking to God if you don't understand what you're saying? And Rav Hirschayer, he's looking at it from the halachic angle, are you yotze or not? And he's saying there's no reason to pray in the vernacular, because as long as you read Hebrew, you're yotze. The fact that the Magen Avraham says on the spot in the Shulchan Aruch there that if you don't know Hebrew, you should do it in the vernacular. I it's not clear to me what the Magen Avraham means, though. We saw Nogat Tzedek cites it, therefore, if you don't understand it, you should read. I think what the Magen Avraham is saying, I take that back, because he's not saying if you don't understand how to read it. I'm not sure. It could be the Magen Avraham when he says that if you don't understand, then you read it in vernacular, he means you literally can't read it. But still, even though in the Nogat Tzedek they understood it to mean that you don't understand the words. But who are we to sympathize with here? If you were to tell most people, without saying it's a dispute between the reformers and the not, which position makes more sense to you? The position that you just recite a prayer that you don't understand it because you technically fulfill the mitzvah, your yotze, or you recite a prayer that you understand? I don't know. I think most people would probably say that it's better the other way. It's better to say it that you understand it. Not sure, though. That's Shire speaking halachically. And he can't acknowledge this, that would be better, because then that opens the door to something that's going to destroy traditional Judaism. No question about it, it'll destroy traditional Judaism. Then he moves on to the issue of the organ. And he says that we only have a tradition of music b'mkom mitzvah. What's b'mkom mitzvah? A wedding. He says there's no mitzvah to use an instrument in prayer, and the proof is that we never did. If there was an inyan, if there was a concept of using music during davening, he says, then how come we haven't been doing it for 2,000 years? That's the biggest proof that there's no such inyan. He does say, he acknowledges, and this is going to be a big issue, in Prague, in the big show in Prague, the Altnoy show, they ushered in Shabbos with music, but only into Bowie Shalom, he says, in Lacha Dodi. But nowhere else, he says, did they do it, which is not 100% accurate, or almost nowhere else, because he does say, he acknowledges also there are some places as well. For example, at the bottom of page 5, he says that he mentions that they used to play instruments. There were places also where they played instruments. He says, let me read his language. Well, first of all, he says that in Prague, it was only in one show, not more. But then he says that it's true that this is the second to last paragraph here. In the earlier days, there in our kehila, namely in Mainz, there were times that they would use music in the show when there was a nisuin of the rich people or to bring in the Shabbos. So he already says that they did it. I don't think he's referring to Germany. I think he's probably referring to our, or maybe he's referring to shows in Germany. He says that, or in the Shabbos before Nisuin or after Nisuin, B'klei Zemer, Ad Bo'i V'Sholom. So he already says that it isn't just in Prague. There was other places as well. But then he says, Ayidei Kach Nasa Teruvas Anashim Anashim. He says that this led to the mixing of men and women. And he says sometimes, and we're not talking here in the 21st century, we're talking about in the 19th century, he says immodest people, or I guess I'd say translate it, or not appropriate people would sing with the music, or would make music, I should say, and the people had to rebuke them. And then he says, but this practice has already been abolished 25 years ago. They abolished this. And today, in the show, the men and women are always separate, et cetera, et cetera. He cites the idea of that you need to have mechitza, et cetera. And then he concludes that anyone who's leaning to this matter, atid l'tena tadin, is going to be called for to account. So a strong rejection of anything, of any changes, an acknowledgement that they used, not on Shabbos, but before Shabbos, they would use instruments in shows, not just in Prague, but elsewhere. But we got rid of it. And today, with the time he's writing, he thinks that there's only one shul that has it in Prague. The next letter comes from the person who's going to be the most important in this whole battle and the one who really determines to a large extent the response. So much so that I'm going to, well, you'll see in a second my point, which I think makes very problematic all these minyanim I showed you playing instruments during the week. And this is from the great Rav Moshe Schreiber, Rav Moshe Sofer, Chatam Sofer, Chasim Sofer. I can't remember if it's 6 or 8 classes on him on Torah in Motion. But he really makes his mark in the battle against reform. We'll come back to him later, since at the end of the volume, there's another very important letter from him. His whole Chadash Hasser Men HaTorah. If it's new, it's forbidden from the Torah. That's going to come, but not now. That comes later. He doesn't have this idea in the first letter. But many of the themes in the Orthodox response to the reformers come from Moshe Sofer. His letter contains nothing unexpected. I made a printout of, I got a copy of the volume here. He speaks of the necessity of keeping the standard version of prayer. He attacks the reformers for getting rid of the prayers for the Messiah. But on page 9, this is what I think is important. His other letter will be more significant, I think. But on page 9, he says that musical instruments are forbidden in shul, since after the Beis Hamikdash is destroyed, there's no rejoicing with instruments except for bride and groom. He says on Shabbos it's also forbidden because it's a shvus b'mkom mitzvah, b'shul b'mkom mitzvah, that it's there's no mitzvah in shul, in davening. We can't create a new mitzvah. There is a mitzvah to rejoice with the groom, with bride and groom. But I want to read you something he writes here. Hold on, where is the words? He says at the bottom here. He says, can you use musical instruments in the Beis Knesset? And he says, we've seen that our forefathers, the ones who established the prayers, never established musical instruments in shul. Even though from us, we're the ones who created music in the Beis Hamikdash. Nevertheless, our forefathers had nothing to do with it. Shema Minah, therefore we see that they didn't like this. From the day the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, we shouldn't have music. And then he cites a proof. It says, Eich Nashira Shira Hashem, in the Psalm, here it is, Psalm 137, famous by Rivers of Babylon. How can we recite a prayer to Hashem on a foreign land? So what does the Chasam Sofer say about this? He says, it doesn't say lifnei, in front of the non-Jews, but just says in the foreign land. Shema Minah, he says that this shows us that even before Hashem, since we're in a non-Jewish land, it doesn't matter where you are. It's not just that they're saying that we can't sing in a foreign land. And by the way, foreign land, even the land of Israel, I guess would be, without the Beis HaMikdash, since conquered by the non-Jews, would be regarded as a foreign land. It doesn't say, how can we sing in front of the non-Jews? It's how can we sing in a foreign land, which means that we can't sing, rejoice like this, no matter what, even before Hashem, is if there's no Beis HaMikdash, if we're not living in the land of Israel. And he says, even though we do permit it for Chasan and Kala, that's a mitzvah. But listen to this. Aval b'beis Hashem, in shul, vaday osur, it is forbidden to have musical instruments. Umagam b'shabbos kodesh, and then certainly on Shabbos, tavei shoshes shol b'chol mitzvah, it's forbidden because it's a shosh b'chol mitzvah. If a non-Jew did it, it would be a shosh shosh. Ki ein koch b'yadenu. You know, we don't have the strength to invent mitzvos. They all of a sudden invented that it's a mitzvah, it's a positive thing to rejoice in shul. And the tefillah is a mitzvah and it's accepted by God without any instruments. And how can we be matur any prohibitions on, he's talking about Shabbos. But notice what he says here. He says that in the house of Hashem, vaday asur. And certainly on Shabbos, umagam b'Shabbos kodesh. When I see this, I have to say that I don't see, at the very least, I think you need to ask a shaila. I mean, because Rav Moshe Sofer is not just some nobody. He's not just some rabbi who said something. I mean, he's someone who's he's like maybe the most significant rabbi of halacha in the last 200 years, or definitely one of the top couple of them. And yes, there are things that are clearly not relevant today. Rav Moshe Feinstein was asked about the issue of a bima in the middle. Shuls, where they're hungry, they said, you can't go to a shul, it doesn't have a bima in the middle. And he said, it's not really relevant today because they're not in the midst of a battle against reform that are making that an issue. But I do think that at the very least, if the Chasam Sofer says, and he gives you the reason why musical instruments do not belong in shul. Shul is just a place, and this is how it was decreed. The davening, and once the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, this is how we did it. It seems to me that the reform, you want to call it a reform of the small R, like we saw, of musical instruments, guitars and clarinets and all these things in davening during the week, it's not so simple to me that that's permissible. I think at the very least, these are one of the things that you have to ask a posek about, because the Chasam Sofer says it's forbidden. And it is the minhag, he says, not to do it. So I think people just assume because it's not Shabbos, it's not a problem. But that's not the issue only. The whole for the Chasam Sofer, the whole idea of bringing of music should be v'simcha shal mitzvah, and you bring a music into the shul. That's not how we daven. That's never been how we daven. Who gives you the right to come up with a new sort of davening where you have instruments in shul? If this was important, then you know something? 500 years ago, they also knew about instruments, and they could have done it. And they played instruments. They played it in the chasana. They played it to rejoice between bride and groom, but they didn't use it during davening, because davening has a set form and a special set way we're supposed to think about it. All I'm saying is that I'm uncomfortable with it unless you'd ask a shaila. I wonder if any of those people asked it, or if they just assumed you could, because it's clearly one of those things that you can't just decide, in my opinion, for what it's worth, that... That's as much breaking with tradition as a lot of other things where the rabbis get all upset about and say it goes against the Masorah. So, okay, let's move on. I want to now go to another important sage who is not so well known today, because he's been overshadowed. But the Chasam Sofer was mevatel himself to a certain extent to him, and that's Rav Mordechai Bennett. Bennett. It's usually spelled B-E-N-E-T, although sometimes it's spelled with an A. Rav Mordechai Bennett, he was the Rav of Nicholsburg. Nicholsburg is the capital of Moravia. If you're the Rav of Nicholsburg, you're the Rav of Moravia. Many Gedolim were there. The Maharal was there. We go there. We go to Nicholsburg. Today they call it Nikolov. And we go to the cemetery and we see his grave and other graves of other Gedolim. Shamshon Raphael Hirsch was the Rav of Nicholsburg, which made him the Rav of all the different communities. But Rav Mordechai Bennett was a very significant figure. It's just that the Chasam Sofer becomes even more significant and overpowers him. But at this time, overpowers him in communal memory. But at this time, Rav Mordechai Bennett was still alive, and he was more distinguished than the Chasam Sofer. There's some great stories about Rav Mordechai Bennett has descendants, has people who are still alive today. He said that the women in Nicholsburg would compete. They would bribe the shamus, his shamus, for the privilege of sewing his garments. And Hirsch, or Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, had enemies in Nicholsburg, old-time Talmidei Chachamim, who didn't like the... He was brought in because the community leaders knew that they needed a modern type of rabbi, but you had these old-fashioned types there who couldn't accept that the world is different. You need a German preacher. You need someone who's going to reach out to everyone. So they would attack him and mock him. And one of the things they attacked him for was that Hirsch would walk down the street with his wife. And they said, well, Mordechai Bennett was here and he walked down the street, all the women would scatter. And, you know, so they went, that was more, they said other things too. They said that before Hirsch, like in the days of Mordechai Bennett, they would learn Gemara and they would just recite Tehillim. But when Hirsch comes, then they just recite Gemara, but they learn Tehillim. It's true. Hirsch believed in you learn Tehillim, you learn the Siddur. So, but Hirsch was the successor. But many, many Gedolim in Nicholsburg, including the Tzemach Tzedek, not the Lubavitch Tzemach Tzedek, but the first Tzemach Tzedek, he's called Menachem Mendel Krochmal. But I can go down the list from David Oppenheim, all the great Gedolim, or many of the great Gedolim, I should say, of Central Europe served in Nicholsburg. So what does Rav Mordechai Bennett say? Well, he says some important things. Quite a long letter. I think he's maybe the most distinguished of the respondents here. Well, first you see, he gets to Aaron Hor and you see enlarged. He says, regarding Aaron Hor and Rabbi and Arad, Chalila kachas Torah mipi b'shum davar. Heaven forbid to listen to him in any way. He has no connection. That means he's not at all learning in Gemara and Poskim. His entire involvement is with Higayon. Higayon is the sages in the Gemara and Brachos, Chaf Chasam Abeis, they forbid teaching Higayon. Now, what is Higayon? A lot of discussion. What exactly it is. Greek philosophy, or some say. In later years, it simply came to mean secular studies. I have to say, though, that Rav Mordechai Bennett is not correct here. Although Chorin was involved in secular studies, to say that in L'yad B'gmor or Poskim Klal, all you have to do is look in the Sfarim, and you could see, and that's what made him so dangerous, that Chorin did have a yad in Gemara and Poskim, but he used it to in the service of reform. He says in the next paragraph, Kafi Anishma, I've heard that in Livorno, one of the Talmidei Chachamim there gave a decision, you know, for them. But I've also heard that he regrets what he did. So we're gonna see exactly what happens with the rabbis of Livorno. And he continues. Other than that, nothing, just a long response. Again, how terrible everything it is. Then we get to a one-page letter, a short letter, from the Beis Din of Prague. There's no chief rabbi in Prague after Noda Behuda, but you have two rabbis very well known. One is Eliezer Fleckels, the Tshuva Me'ava. Actually, it's a Lazar Fleckless, so they printed it mistakenly. And Shmuel Segel Lando, that's the son of the noted Yehuda. Rav Shmuel Lando, he's a Dayan on the Beis Din. I think he becomes Av Beis Din, but he's not, he was never Rav of the city. The next Rav was Shir, Shmuel Yehuda Rappaport. But Rav Shmuel Lando is famous. He wrote Tshuvas. There's Tshuvas in the Notab Yehuda written by Rav Shmuel Lando. One of the most famous Tshuvot of the Notab Yehuda was actually written by his son. People don't realize that. The Tshuva of the Notab Yehuda, where he says he rejects the idea of Shitov, that non-Jews are not bound, this concept that non-Jews are not bound by pure belief in one God. It's a justification for Christianity for non-Jews. They can believe in one God with different parts. The Notab Yehuda strongly rejects this. But it's not the Notab Yehuda. It's not Rav Yechazkel Lando. It's Rav Shmuel Lando. So what do the rabbis of Prague say? You see the end of the first paragraph? After discussing the apikorsus of them and how they pray in different languages, he says, Aval b'emes einam lo ivrim v'lo notzrim. They are not Hebrews, not Jews, and they're not notzrim. They're not Christians. Again, if they're not Jews and if they're not Christians, well, then there's some sect. Sects are illegal. You can shut them down. This is an appeal to the government. They're saying to the government that these people are not Jews. Now, what does it mean they're not Jews? If a Reformed Jew were to betroth a woman with two witnesses, the Dayanim in Prague would say she needs a get. No question about it. But speaking polemically with an eye to the government, they're saying, black and white, that they're not Hebrews, they're not Christians, they're some sect. Halakhically, they're Jewish, yes, but they don't live as Jews. They live as some sort of sectarian. No different than if someone's baptized Catholic and then you start following some Christian sect. You're not a Catholic. You're a sectarian. These are not Hebrews. They're sectarians. And then it talks about they use an organ. It's absolutely forbidden, even with a non-Jew. And it says, though, those in our congregate community, remember, in the Altnoy show, they played an organ. He says, and other instruments as well. He says, those in our synagogues who use instruments in Kabbalah Shabbos, they have to get rid of them half hour before Baruch Hu. That is, they would do Kabbalah Shabbos. They would stop in the middle. They'd get rid of the instruments. They'd wait. I guess they had learning or a drasha. And then they'd start with Meir. So here you have testimony, although the Chasam Sofer says you can't use it at all. Yet we know, forget about Italy and other places, in Prague. Prague is a place where the greatest Gedolim were rabbis of in the Altnoy Shul. Everyone knows, obviously, the Maharal and the Rabbi Yehuda. What about the Tosas Yom Tov? What about Yutah? What about the Lavush? People forget about the Lavush. And yet, although I have, truth be told, I don't know when they started with the organs. It was after the Notab Yehuda. It was after the Maharal and after the Lavush. But you always had the greatest Gedolim as rabbis there, and they had an organ there. Granted, they didn't play on Shabbos with a non-Jew, but they had an organ that would stand in contradiction to the Chasam Sofer's point. And then in the next paragraph, it says, and don't tell me about this book that was printed in Dessau, Sefer Pasul, which is called Nogat Tzedek. What does Nogat Tzedek mean? It means light of righteousness. They call it Choshech Ra. If they have Nogat Tzedek, it's evil darkness. You can't rely on it at all. The whole point of it is to entice the Jews into reforms. And they signed this letter. It's dated Tufkafai and Tet, which is 1819. And this is the great rabbis. We've done a lot today. Let me take the questions here. Hold on a second. Just want to get a date here of someone. Okay, I will. Let me get to the questions, comments. Well, so next week we're going to pick up more discussions of the rabbis and introduce you some different figures. And then we return to Rav Moshe Sofer, the Chasam Sofer, because he is well known for his idea of Chodesh Osur Min HaTorah. What does this mean, Chodesh Osur Min HaTorah? How does he use it? Why does he use it? We'll see the great debate between him and the Maaretz Chayyus. Do you have to be honest when dealing with reformers? And when trying to influence the public, the Jewish public, do you really need to be honest with them? Do you have to explain to everyone that, well, technically it's permitted, let's say, to do this, but we can't allow it because of what it's going to lead to? Or can you simply tell them it's usur? And that's fine. They're the masses. Who says the masses need to know everything? That's so we will get into that very interesting, dispute. So let me see some of the comments. Yes, Thomas said the Ben Ish Chai's endorsement of bat mitzvah. He does, even before him, the Rabbi Avraham Musafia, although he's speaking about a little at home, you do something at home. You rejoice at home, as opposed to something in the synagogue. That becomes the big issue in the synagogue. Oh, Rabbi Kamo says, yes, the Otzar Yisrael. Otzar Yisrael is still a valuable work. Otzar Yisrael is an encyclopedia. It isn't all written by Eisenstein, although he wrote most of the entries. Rav Kook has entries in the Otzar Yisrael. The Ritzbah, no, not the Rav Chaim Berlin has entries. You have Gedol Yisrael with entries in the Otzar Yisrael. And it's, if you don't know the Otzar Yisrael, that was, right around the time the Jewish Encyclopedia appeared, the Otzar Yisrael, and you look in the first volume, it has the, maybe all the volumes might have it right at the beginning, who contributed? As I said, Rav Kook contributed. So, yes, the Otzar Yisrael is still a good work. David Eisen says, apropos of Eisenstein's wonderful collections, you give us a page there from his illustrated Haggadah that has the Russia appearing as a bare-chested boxer, capturing a great moment in Jewish American history. That's been copied many times, that picture as well. I'm going to, hold on a second, I'm going to show people so that they can see. I'm going to share my screen with you for those who, for posterity here, for the people who are going to be watching later. Here's the Russia. So you have the, we all know who the Chacham is, and then you got the Russia, the simple one, the one who doesn't even know how to ask. I guess the one who doesn't even want to ask is all the way on the left, I guess. Okay, thank you very much for that, David. Very nice. Okay, let me get to some more questions here. Someone privately asked, did Avraham Avinu know how beautiful Sarah was? I'm not sure what the connection is to what we are talking about. You have to remind me. If you remember, he says when they go down to Egypt, I have to cover you up, so, stick you in the box here, because now I see how beautiful you are. So on the spot, the Midrash says, I think it's even quoted in Rashi there. What? He never knew? He's been with her? And they give two explanations there. I think it's Rashi. If not, it's definitely in the Midrash. One explanation is that, it's one thing when we were back in Canaan, you had time for all your makeup and everything, but here we're going through the desert. Now I see how beautiful you are, because even though we're passing through all these journeys, you still look good. I know you're beautiful. The other explanation is, he says that, we passed through all these lands and, I see how ugly everyone else is. Now I realize how beautiful you are. Before, I didn't know. I just thought you were you. But now I see the rest of the world and how ugly they are. And we are now about to enter into Egypt, and they're all ugly down there. So we gotta hide you. But I'm not sure for the person who texted me. I forget. You gotta tell me what that has to do with what we are doing. Remind me. The story about Ellie says about the story of the Chasam Sofer, Akiva Eger. There's it's a story in the family of the Chasam Sofer as well. I would say traditional Judaism equals Yiddishkeit. Definitely for the Ashkenazi. Danny says, what about the introduction of Kabbalah Shabbos as a change? It's a good point. Kabbalah Shabbos is the last change in the Siddur that was basically universally accepted. It was not accepted in Frankfurt. I don't know about the Hirschian community. Some Hirschians will have to tell me. I don't know if in the mid 19th century in the Hirschian community they did Kabbalah Shabbos. They did not do it in the regular, the Gemeinde, the Gross Gemeinde community. Until the end of the 19th century, they didn't. It is a change, and you're right. You could say that they just said that in opposition, and we're going to see again and again the opponents of reform say that you can't have any changes in the service. And Chodesh Osim in the Torah. So how is Kabbalah Shabbos not a change? I think you can say Kabbalah Shabbos came before. it came before the reformers. So then you didn't have the issue because you didn't have reformers. So as long as you didn't have reformers, then you can have changes. All it means is that changes happen much slower, and they happen at the end of the day. It's if the great rabbis approve the changes, then it's okay. But still, this whole dispute that we're looking at right now led to such a conservatism. The idea when religious Zionist rabbis wanted to have a Zecher to Hakel at the Kotel. No, you can't, because it's a reform. We can't have reforms. When they wanted to have one Kina for the Holocaust, you can't do it. When they wanted to have a fast day in memory of the Holocaust, you can't do it because we can't have any changes. In the Ashkenazic world, you forget Yom HaTzmaut, Yom Yerushalayim, this whole dispute with the reformers created such conservative approach that you can't do anything. You can't make any changes. And it's all due to the reformers. So much so that Rav Yecheskel Abramsky, when he was asked about the kashrus of gelatin, he says that he thinks it's mutter. He says, but we can't permit it because people have accepted not to eat it, and we can't make any changes. That because we're in a generation where people are saying that the Torah is malleable. So we all know that that's a big concern. It was a big concern with the bat mitzvah. It was a concern with the prenuptial agreements. Because everything is always look over your shoulder. The difference is that in the 20th century, they weren't saying, look at the reformers. Because the reformers are already mechutz l'machaneh. What they were saying is, look at the conservative. But it was the same argument. In the 19th century, you couldn't do any of these things because look at the reformers. They're trying to make changes. In the 20th century, you couldn't do it because look at the conservative. We spoke all about this last semester. In the Sephardic world, you didn't have any of these concerns. If you take every time the poskim say that technically something is permissible, but we can't permit it because of the slippery slope. And if you remove the caveat, then that's what psak looks like in the Sephardic world, because they don't need to be concerned with that. They just can look at the halacha and take it to where it goes without that caveat. Okay, so yeah, David, that's the yatei he's citing from Yecheskel, where it's masculine. But there's other places. I remember I said, I think one place, but there's a two or three or maybe more where it's feminine. So both are acceptable. Someone privately texts that the Yemenite tradition is the man of the household says the Berakas Mazel for everyone at the table. That also could go back to the fact that maybe they didn't know. David says that my colleague, Professor Adam Furziger, who right now is in New Jersey, he's a visiting scholar at Rutgers. He's very proud of the role held by one of his female ancestors who served as the Fritziger, which the woman who would call out to other women, the Ezra Snashin, who was fluent in the davening and would announce to the women that the section of the Siddur is being recited at that time in the synagogue. But that's not the vernacular. We know also that she knew Hebrew. But for instance, in Prague, we knew 500 years ago or 400 years ago, there was a woman chazan. We have the whole description. The women would get together. Actually, take that back. I think I can't remember now whether she did it in Judeo-German or in Hebrew. I think Judeo-German. And we have the case in Salonika. We have other cases where women would daven in the vernacular. Ellie says, regarding Hebrew and understanding, we read Torah Megillah. How many people really understand it? We don't need to understand it. That's the point. It's never been stated that the Biyot say you need to understand it. You just need to read it properly. That's what Hebrew is different. Hebrew especially. Haggadah shel Pesach, that's the time where they say you have to understand it. And therefore, it's not conservative or not frum to recite the Haggadah in English. If you want, you recite in Hebrew also and in English. So the point is, Dafka, everyone has to, and not everyone needs to understand it, not just the man of the house. Everyone, and especially the children. So Haggadah shel Pesach, that's, as far as I know, that's the only time where we assume that you have to, and a couple words in Megillas Esther that have to be read in Hebrew by the Chazan. But other than that, when do we say that you need to, and then Neder, things like that. But in terms of rituals that we have to do, I can't think of any. Remind me where we say that you have to understand what you're saying. Oh, selling, I guess, Kol Chamira before Pesach. There you need to understand it. Because otherwise, but that's not a prayer. That's like, that's no different than I make a contract. I need to understand the contract. You know, I'm declaring something odorless, so I need to understand what I'm saying. But in terms of prayers, are there any other prayers that you need to understand? I don't think so. iPad says that the Chasam Sofer wants to learn normative halacha from Tehillim, written by, from the generation of exiles. So we learn normative halacha. They were asked to play by the very people who exiled them. what you're getting at is a good point that Chaim Soloveitchik, I'll read you a quote he has. He says it's obvious that the poskim are bending over backwards not to permit something that they could have permitted, but they can't permit it. So they have to find reasons. But just to defend the Chasam Sofer, the fact remains that it's Minhag Yisrael from day one not to have music in the shul. If they wanted to have music in the shul, they could have established it in Frankfurt 500 years ago. They could have established it in Vilna 500 years ago. They didn't. And that to him is enough of a proof. So why didn't they? He makes a nice drasha from the Pasuk in Tehillim, but it's not based on that. He's just giving that as an extra thing. It's based on the Masorah that he says it explicitly, that we didn't, no one did it. And I think that's convincing. Ruth says that the shul is a mikdash ma'at, the musical instrument should be normative. Why? Just because it has the same name, mikdash ma'at? The mikdash ma'at is just a nice way we call it that. I mean, it's not really a mikdash. We don't do anything in there like we do in the base of mikdash. We call it a mikdash ma'at because that's what we have. We don't have sacrifices, and we don't do music there either. Look, you could make the argument that we should have music there, but the Chasam Sofer is saying the proof is in the pudding. We never did. And that shows you that that's not our minhag. Now, as for Simcha, what about Simchas Yom Tov, Samach B'Chagach? Okay, that's a good point. So you should say that you have it, play it on Yom Tov. What they're going to argue is that there's Simcha and there's Simcha. Certain Simchas call for dancing and music. Those, not only don't they call for it, Yom Tov, according to the Strict Halacha, you're not allowed to dance, as we saw last week. You're not allowed to dance on Yom Tov. We are more lenient as Ashkenazim, and they make one exception to Simchas Torah. But yes, we're obligated to rejoice on Yom Tov, but not through music and not through dancing. They go together. That's what they would say. In terms of getting rid of the instruments, you're right. I shouldn't have said getting rid of the instruments. They said put them away. So what he's referring to there, he says that they had not just in Prague, they didn't just have organs. They had other instruments also. So when they say put them away, I still think when they say put them away, they're referring to not just to all the instruments. And they covered it with something, perhaps. So that's also technically they could call it that. But we know they had an organ in Prague as well as other instruments. But they stopped before. So someone, the private person, when he asked, did Avraham know how beautiful Sarah was? And he says, well, then it relates to Rekiv Eger and his daughter. He didn't notice his daughter. But Avraham did notice. He says explicitly, unless you want to say that that's the first time he saw how beautiful she was. But the two Midrashim I quoted are otherwise. He says he saw her. He just didn't recognize the significance in her beauty. And as someone probably points out, Eisenstein also published an English defense of the Torah. Published posthumously in 1960. That is absolutely correct. And it's an interesting commentary. It's, when you understand who his grandson was, it's even more interesting. Judah David Eisenstein was one of the people, if you read, he also has Otsar Zichron Asai. It has to be translated to English one day. It's his memoir. He was very close to the Ridbaz and the Orthodox community that brought the Ridbaz, Yaakov Yosef. He talks about the Ridbaz also. If anything you want to know about the Orthodox community in New York in the earlier 20th century, you got to look at Eisenstein, all the disputes. He has everything there. And
forget the early 20th century. He also has the 19th century.
He does. He does have the 19th century as well.
Fascinating reading.
He comes to America in the end of the 19th century. And Yaakov Yosef is the end of the 19th century, correct? I could go on long and someone says Hataras Nedarim, yes, okay. Hataras Nedarim is not a prayer though; it's different. But you're right. Thank you. I think there's so much, and we've already gone long enough. David says the Rambam rules that one must understand the first bracha of the Amida, while others interpret the Rambam that one must not necessarily understand the meaning, but understand the same for Hashem. That's what we assume, I think. I'll just add one more thing. There's another thing you see that we don't understand necessarily what we're saying, but it's still pious. the practice of reciting Tehillim became a pious endeavor where people would recite Tehillim even without understanding what they were saying, but the recitation was itself an act of piety. And then later in the Sephardic world, like in Morocco, for instance, people would recite the Zohar without knowing what it means, but that has significance. But the important point is that Hebrew is different than the vernacular. You say Berei Pri HaEtz, you don't need to know what it says. You just need to know that before a fruit, this is what you read, and you can read a transliteration, and you're Mekayim the Bracha. No problem.
A little anecdote. Yehuda David Eisenstein has an entry in there. He was at the opening of the Brooklyn Bridge. He was an honored guest, and he talks about the opening of the Brooklyn Bridge.
Ah, very nice. I'll need to check it out. I only skimmed it, and it's been a long time, but lots of good stuff there. He traveled America. Thank you for that. Rabbi Kelman, take it away.
Okay, thank you very much. All right. Yeah. I mean, I'd heard of it. I don't know the last time I saw it, maybe 40 years ago, maybe never. It was sitting on a chair, right? I think that was very fascinating. I was reading his entry on Shadal, a few other entries, just like flipping through the pages of Otzer Yisrael. Just interesting that you should mention it. Okay.
You can see, you can go online, Otzer Chochma, and not Otzer Chochma, that too. But HebrewBooks.org, you can see the Otzer Yisrael.
Right, okay, I'm just saying, it was lying there in shul, so you can always start reading it.
Many of them have been republished, I don't know by who, but you know, in Eretz Yisrael, you can find it very easy. I don't know about here in the United States, but you can find almost all the Otzers in new volumes.
Reb Chaim Kanievsky has notes on one of the Otzer, I forget which one, Otzer Midrashim, I think that's what it is. There's an Otzer Midrashim, so Reb Chaim Kanievsky has notes on it.
Yeah, but okay, that's right. That and the 100 years from the Bat Mitzvah. That's how this all got started. That's yes. I was at the J.J. Schechter lecture when he was doing the 70, his three lectures on Mordechai Kaplan for the 75th anniversary of the Jewish Center in, I guess, 1993. I think the Jewish Center started in 1918, if I'm not mistaken. And they gave he gave a 3-part series. He was the rabbi then. It was meant as a 1-part thing. My brother was like the rabbinic, the first assistant rabbi for there. So I happened to be there that Shabbos, and quite a fascinating talk on Mordechai Kaplan's relationship to the Orthodox, which of course he later wrote a book about, the long and tortured relationship of Mordechai Kaplan and the Orthodox. But he talked about the Bat Mitzvah, and he interviewed the granddaughter, I think. Anyways, okay, lots of interesting stuff. Look forward to seeing you next week. Tomorrow morning, 11 a.m.
Eastern. The last week, the last week before Pesach.
Right, of course, obviously. Yeah. Obviously.
And, okay.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Last week for Pesach. And the Pesach is only 10 days away. I don't know, 11 days away, whatever it is. Okay. Everybody should get excited. Pesach's time of Simcha, Yontif, exciting, always good. Okay. Tomorrow morning, Rachel Sharansky Danziger, 11 a.m. She has 2 more classes on Sefer Shmot. That's tomorrow at 11. Alex Israel's series is finished. And then Wednesday, Ari Mermelstein will say, did God originally intend to inflict the 10 Makot? That's Wednesday at 11 a.m. and 8 p.m. Dr. Sokolow is second last part in his series on how Tanakh was put together. Now we're in translations. And Thursday morning, Shuli Mishkin will be giving a class on the Exodus and archaeology. And then Thursday night, Rabbi Nadi Helfgott will be giving the Parsha de Shavuot Shir 8:30 Thursday. And then my weekly Shir 9 a.m. on the Siddur on Friday. That concludes the week. And we look forward to learning with you and seeing you. And like I say, please invite a friend and have a Laila Tov. And all the best. Thank you very much. Be well, everybody.
Laila Tov.
Laila Tov, Vakasha.